everyone today.
Thank you there. Saw a few nodding heads just now. Pretty tiring day. So before I start, I'd just like to express my thanks and gratitude to, first of all, Unibuds, because this is where I initially got in touch with Buddhism when I was a student, and was this particular platform, this particular space, that allowed me and gave me resources to continue learning more about Buddhism, and made a lot of friends along the way, and a lot of spiritual friends as well along the way. So I thought that was, pretty helpful. And so since I've benefited quite a lot from here, I thought it'd be nice if one day I can come back and give back to some of the things that I've learned along the way. So thanks for having me tonight. And also, good effort, people, for being here on a Friday night, especially. I know it's a mid-sem break starting next week. So instead of going out somewhere having a party, we're here listening to a talk. All right, so I'll try and share with you what I've learned and what I've researched a bit, and also a bit about what I've come across my profession to explore a bit about this topic, dying to live. So when Alan first called me and said, "Can you give a talk?" And it's like, "Oh, okay, well, what's the topic? If it's something terribly difficult, maybe I'll leave that to the monks or the nuns." And then he said it was, the topic is about death, dying to live. And I'm like, oh, jaw drop. So, okay, all right, let me think about this. I'll give you a call back. Then I thought, maybe I can somehow contribute to this because, as Alan said, in my profession during the day, I am a medical doctor. So I do, day in, day out, I do come across people who are sick. That's why they're in hospital, right? And yes, I do come across death as well. So maybe there is something in there that I can talk about and share with everyone tonight. Then I sort of looked a bit deeper into it. And so this topic is dying to live. So are we dying to live in a sense that, we struggle every moment to try and live? Or do we eventually live to die? So I guess it's a difference in the attitude or the look on living and dying, isn't it? So let's see what we can take away from tonight. So across tonight, we'll try and see, we'll try and explore a few things. We'll see how we go. But basically, it'll be a bit about understanding more about our body. Because that's what we have, right? Day in, day out, you wake up, you brush your teeth, that's your body, you wash your face. It's all related to your body. You walk around, it's your body. So we'll try and explore this body a bit more and see what is it about this body and what is it about dying? And how do we try? I'm not enlightened yet, but we'll see what we can do to work towards accepting sickness and death, right? So, back in 2,500 years ago, or 2,600 years now, before Buddha became enlightened, he was Prince Siddhartha. He lived a life of comfort, young, handsome, rich, he's like the dream person, right? It was in comfort. In fact, the story goes that he had his father built three different palaces for him, right? One for a different season, and then everyone in there was all beautiful and young and fit and all that. But he didn't feel quite settled. He took a journey and he went out of the palace, and then he saw a few things that eventually propelled him to seek this spiritual path, right? So, do you all know what he saw? What were the four sights? Yes? No, maybe oh. question mark. Hmm?
Yep. Deaf monk.
Yeah. So yes, old Sikh deaf monk. Okay, so yes, he did see someone who is he did see someone on the street who is an elderly and never saw that before, so he thought it was weird, huh? What's that? Am I gonna be like that one day? And then his servant did tell him, yes, everyone will get old one day. There's no escaping that. Then he saw someone who is sick. I think sickness in those days is a lot different from what we see, you know. We achoo and I'm sick. And but in those days, probably without the proper medicines, sick and death probably means, you know, you've got rashes all over, you're crooked, your skin is shriveled, you know, just quite terminal stages of sickness. So it's quite obvious that this man is sick. And then saw a dead person who's motionless, death, no color. And then he saw a monk who kind of offered a different take on life, isn't it? Because at the end of the day, we'll all face death. But our value of life and how we look at it can be quite different, you know. So as the saying goes, there's two inevitable things in life, right? There's taxes. By the way, have you all done your tax returns? I haven't. Oops. And the other one is death, right? No one escapes death. At least we're all not immortal. But yet people feel very uncomfortable talking about death. You know. And so, like I said, in my profession, I see sick people every day. And I do sick. Every now and again, I'm asked to certify someone who's dead. So, what is it about this body? Can we control our body? Yeah, you think? Stunned silence. No. Yeah. Sometimes we think we can, but more often than not, we can't. In fact, we don't have control of our bodies, isn't it? I mean, do we want to be sick? Who's gotten sick this recent winter? Yeah. So have I. In fact, I was a bit glad to be sick so I can take a few days off. But yeah, I mean, did you ask to be sick? Did you say, no, I don't want to be sick, go away, sickness? You know, we still fell sick, right? So we can't control sickness. We can try and reduce it. We can do certain steps to try and stay healthy and prevent illness. But when it comes, you just can't prevent it. So I thought I'd spend a little bit of time, since I'm a doctor as well, try and explore the human body, and we'll see if it's in fact true that we cannot control our body. Are there any medical students tonight? Yes? No? Maybe? No? I was hoping some of them would be here, then I don't need to go through everything.
It's okay, you have plenty of time.
Yeah. So what's at the center of our chest? A very important organ. Yeah. We often talk about the heart, right? I mean, what do you think the heart does?
Pumping the blood.
Correct. It pumps the heart. It pumps the blood. It pumps the blood around the body, correct? Yeah? And unlike a mechanical pump where you sort of turn it on, turn it off, it keeps pumping even when you're asleep, even when you're not aware of it. Yeah. So, you know, sometimes when I picture the human body, and I think, it's like, wow, the heart sounds like it's pretty tired, you know. It's like, all day long, no rest. I mean, it's a pretty awful job, right? Imagine if I ask you to keep pumping something the whole day around. But it just doesn't stop, correct? I mean, the moment it stops, you're kind of dead, right? Do you think about ordering your heart to pump? Do you think you can stop it intentionally if you wanted to? Like, if you were like, stop, 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 stop. Do you think it stops? You can't, isn't it? And if those people who are somehow still conscious when their heart stops, I don't know if that's possible. But if they, even if they try and picture it to try and start, do you think their heart can start? No, isn't it? So really, the heart in itself just keeps pumping along by itself. I'm sure it's under the control of nervous systems and whatnot. But if you look at it in that way, you can't control whether your heart starts or stops, isn't it? I mean, let's not talk about medications, but in itself, it just keeps doing its job, day in, day out. And the heart, like everything else, it's got a beautiful, like an electrical system. So it conducts certain impulses, it orders the muscles to move. And along the course of age, sometimes the wiring system burns out a bit. Wear and tear. Just can't help it as well. That's why some people, you know, they have fainting spells and then they become okay. And this goes on. We can sometimes do something about it with additional devices, but in itself, you can't prevent it from wearing out. Agree? Don't agree?
Yes.
Stunned silence. Yeah. So, that's just the electricals of the heart. You know, and then there's other things like heart attacks. They can come pretty suddenly. Sometimes warning, sometimes there's no warning. Okay, so that's the gist of the heart, right? So we agree that, yeah, we can't quite control the heart. Yeah? Okay. So let's look at another organ. Let's look at the kidney. Everyone knows what's a kidney? Yeah? So what's the function of the kidney?
Filter.
Yeah, that's right. So it acts as a huge filter. It filters your blood, get rid of the waste products, whatever junk you eat and drink, it's handled by the liver, and then the rest of the stuff, it has to go out somewhere, right? So your kidney is a big filter. It does a lot of things. And again, sometimes I think, you know, it would be nice if we could, like, you know, do you guys have fishes or have seen fish tanks? And then there's like a filter at the end of the drain. And sometimes I just imagine like, oh, how nice if it's, I can just take it out and just wash and just put it back and then I can have a clean filter once again. It's like, can't quite do that in the kidney. It's a bit unfortunate. So yeah, again, I'm actually doing a term in the kidney department now. And so we see a lot of patients with kidney problems. And so sometimes I ask my consultant, hey boss, why is this person's kidney so stuffed? I say, oh well, age is a risk factor. I'm like, oh, okay. Can't do anything about that. So, okay, then there's other things like high blood pressure, diabetes, etc., etc. Okay, well, we can do something to manage that, but it's like age. Oh. So, in other words, you and I, there are some people in the audience who are a bit elderly than me. So, generically, let's say 20, 30 years down the track, our kidneys will start to run into some problems as age is a risk factor, correct? So again, it's also subjected to wear and tear. And then there's also other problems related to kidneys if they don't function very well. So do you know that the kidney also is involved in helping you make red blood cells? Yeah, it's not a very popular known function of the the kidneys. You know, they don't go hanging banners saying, "Hey, I make your blood cells." But yes, so as you grow older, as the kidneys also start to grow in wear and tear, you can find yourself getting more tired. Your red blood cells decrease. Okay. So again, you can't quite command whether how much the kidney filters, isn't it? Like, are you even aware that you're making urine? You're not, right? Are you even aware that there's blood flowing through your kidneys and just filtering stuff? You're not even aware of it, right? Okay, well, we're not even aware, much less to say trying to control it, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, so the heart, yeah, can't quite control it. Kidneys, didn't even know that it's there doing its job. Okay, well, let's explore another organ. Any organs you want to explore, guys? How about the liver? Have you ever wondered where all the food you eat goes to? Like, you know, what did you have for lunch? What do you have for lunch, William?
Chicken roll.
Yeah? Okay. You?
Fish and chips.
Yeah. What's in the chicken roll and fish and chips? Okay, there's
chicken.
Meat. Yes, there's meat, there's protein. There's oil, there's, I don't know, proteins, there's carbohydrates and all these things. They get digested, and then where does it go? I'll give you a hint, it's something we just mentioned. Yeah, that's correct. Wow. So yeah, so everything that you eat sort of gets processed in the liver. Did you know that? Yeah. Does anyone drink alcohol? Not going to judge you. I know it's a Buddhist session, but anyone drinks alcohol sometimes? Okay, let's say you do. Okay. Did you know the number one rising liver problems in Australia is going to be alcohol related? So it's pretty much whatever you put in through your mouth eventually ends up being processed in the liver. Which is why it's important to watch what you eat. But again, it goes on day in, day out. Sometimes you eat good food, sometimes you eat rubbish food, sometimes you drink alcohol, fingers crossed. But they all get handled by the liver. And what the liver does is it breaks it down, it sort of makes it into something that your body is able to accept. So if you imagine, you know, when you start eating when almost with the moment you're born, isn't it? You may have your mother's milk to start with, and then after that you go on some solid food. They all get digested, they all get handled, chemically processed. We're still eating now, we're still... So, assuming our lifespan is 80 years old, so from day 1 until 80, the liver also works non-stop. Just keeps processing whatever we put in through our mouths. It's helpful if you put in good stuff, not so helpful if you put in things like alcohol for long term. And other poisonous stuff, because then you start having liver problems. So, okay. Didn't even know that the liver does all that. So much less to say that we can control the liver. Just happily goes there. Let's go to something a little bit more interesting. What about your hormones? Are you aware that your brain sort of secretes some of these chemicals that make you happy, not happy, make your body function? Don't quite know, right? I'll give you an example. Not trying to be sexist, but it's true that the male and female body is different, right? So once a month in the female body, there's a surge of certain hormones. And sometimes it can make your mood a little bit difficult to control, yeah? For anyone who's in a relationship, I'm sure, for the guys, I'm sure that sometimes you get this crazy rant from your girlfriends about some weird things that you don't quite understand. And sometimes it's the hormones doing that. It's something called PMS. But having said so, doesn't mean that we are subjected to the mercy of this automatic process that keeps going on in our body, you know? When I say that, you know, some females are very sensitive to the hormones and they get very irritable that time of the month. But let's take a break and look at some of the monastics, the monks and the nuns, right? They spend a lot of time training themselves, developing their mind, meditation practices, practicing compassion. And irregardless of any time when we meet them, you always get a sense of joy and peace, correct? They're still female. The nuns still have a female body. They haven't changed so much physiologically. But I get a sense that they're able to be aware of these emotions and let that go. So there is a way that we can exist peacefully with our bodies and just get on top of these situations, being mindful, being aware. Yeah? So I've mentioned a few things about the human body, and the point that I'm trying to illustrate is that sometimes we think we can control the body, but just breaking it down, looking at it from the different organs, we can't actually, can we? You know, it's sort of this automatic process that keeps running the moment, the day you're born, even slightly before you're born. And then it kind of keeps running and running and running and running and running and running. And there's only, it's a one-way street. It will only go downhill. All right? There is a period there where your body reaches its maximum capacity. So all of you who are not yet 30, please keep exercising, okay? You'll have a chance to build up your bones and develop all these things, because from then on, it's a gradual downhill. Okay? And there's no reverse button to say that I want to... if only I did a bit more exercise, my bones would have been stronger. I want to do it now. It's like, sorry, no go. No, until someone invents a time machine, I don't think we can do that. So what I'm trying to illustrate here is that we can't control our bodies. We can't control the functions of our bodies. We can influence it, though, but we don't have control over the body. What I mean by influence, so we all know that if you eat healthily, this is a broad statement, if you eat healthily, you exercise. I mean, for those of you who go to the gym enough, not a one-off, oh, I went to the gym yesterday, why are my muscles not popping out? Like, hello, you need to keep practicing and give it time, okay? But if you continuously exercise or you influence your body, then sure, it behaves in a certain way. And things like, you know, good habits, not smoking, eating healthily, exercise. So we can exert a certain influence on the body. Agree? Yeah? But when we're talking about control, no. Because if we can control our body, then I'm pretty sure we can all be mortal. Like, who would choose to die? Or who would choose to be sick? Maybe if I want an off day, I'd try to be sick, but... does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. So, and sometimes these things can happen quite suddenly. I remember a few cases that at work where, you know, I was asked to see this patient. He's on the cancer ward. it's fine. I went to see him. It's like, oh, how are you, sir? It's like, yeah, I'm okay. A little bit breathless, but okay. It's like, look at your blood pressure. Look at the charts. No, blood pressure's okay. Heart rate's okay. Oxygen levels are okay. Temperature's okay. It's like, yeah, yeah, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. So I left and went to do my other things. And half an hour later, I got an emergency call, and I came running back, and he's dead. So it can happen, just snap. Who knew what happened? Something catastrophic. I mean, sure, his health wasn't great to start with, so in a way, his death wasn't all that unexpected. But still, it can come at a random time. And just today, I remember seeing this guy just a week ago, and I said, all right, well, look, I'll see you in clinic in about, you know, 2-3 weeks' time. And then they gave me a call saying, oh, look, this patient's pretty sick. I think he was seen by you about a week ago. Can you come and view him? So I'm like, oh, okay. What's happening? Oh, you know, I don't know. He's a bit breathless, a bit of tummy aches. And then apart from my usual background, I said, oh, man, not another patient to see. And thinking, why are you calling me? This guy's breathless. You should call the lung department or, you know, the heart department. Don't call the renal department, man. I don't deal directly with the lungs. But anyways, then I looked at his blood test and said, oh, crap. This guy's pretty sick. And when I went to see him, he's pretty much unconscious. And he had a tube down his throat, stuck on a life support machine. And the next thing I knew was a conversation with the family saying, oh, looks like he's not doing well. He might very well die today. Well, thankfully, family were accepting that his health was in pretty poor shape. But, you know, last when I saw him a week ago, I thought, you know, I thought he was fine. And he looked fine at that stage. So, believe it or not, but death can come at quite unexpected times. Car accidents, stroke. There can be, someone can be very well a moment ago, and these things can happen just quite suddenly. Yeah. So, again, death as we know is inevitable. Yeah? The timing of it, we don't know either. And all of you here are young and healthy, I presume. If you're not, go and see your doctor. Don't see me. I'm not here for consultations. But all of you here are fit and healthy, and you know you've got a lot of plans made. But in the background, there's always this thing about we're not able to control our bodies, and then there's this thing that death can happen quite suddenly. So, but the way we look at death can be quite different. And the most peaceful deaths I've seen in hospital are the ones that are generally very accepting. It's those that are very resistive to dying that usually have the most suffering. And it's not just suffering for the people themselves, the patients themselves, but it's also the family. So the happiest deaths I've seen, right? I know it's a weird thing to say, but the happiest deaths I've seen are like, you know, this elderly, maybe 90-year-olds, and they can sometimes be happily demented. You know, by that I mean they may be sitting in a chair the whole day, and when you go talk to them, like, oh, I just went fishing. Don't even know there's a pond in the hospital, but okay. So they're happily demented, you know. And then sometimes some of them still have a little bit of idea of what's going on. And when you talk to them, they're like, oh, yeah, when the time comes, I'm ready. And sort of families have already had these conversations. They all know, yep, at some point in time, mom or dad will eventually pass away. They've all made their preparations, you know, linked in with the funeral homes, etc. And the patients themselves, there's no fear. No, there's no fear. They're accepting of it. They know that it will come. Don't know when. They're not fighting it. Just when it comes, it comes. It's part of nature. And at those times, when I review the bodies to certify that they're dead, there's usually a sense of calm. It's It's not something I can quantify or qualify. You know, it's just there's just this general sense of calm. Like the room is just dimly lit, and there's just a sense of peace. And then when family's there and they've already gone through the conversations and they're prepared for it, sure, they will be sad. Okay, there's some tears, but the overall atmosphere is just that it's a song. Okay, they passed away. Let's move on. Yeah. But those that is like, oh, please do everything you can, and like, oh my goodness, your heart's not great, your lungs, you can barely breathe, and your kidneys are shutting down, your blood pressure's through the roof, and this patient's just holding on to you, saying, doctor, please do something to me. I want to live. I want to live. I want to live. And then family are there, and then they can see that there's so much struggle there. But they can't do anything about it. And they look to you, and then I look at them, and it's like, I can't. But, you know, professionally, we have to say that, yes, we'll try and do what we can. And it's true, we do look at what we can do. We can try and treat the reversible things. But then there's this fear. There is a very strong sense of fear. There is a sense of unacceptance. There's a sense of pushing away. It's like, I don't want to die. So they're stressed, family stressed, and when it eventually comes to the moment, all the peacefulness, calmness, atmosphere that I've talked about, it's just not there. There's people wailing, there's shouting, you know. It's just not a pleasant thing. So, death is inevitable, but the way we look at it, the way we treat it, and the way we approach it can be very different. And the outcomes can be very different for the person, as well as the family, you know? So, I've spoken about my own experiences and some of the deaths I've seen, and we've explored a little bit about the human body. So what is it about the Buddha's teachings and the attitudes towards death? So what I've done is I've looked at some of the Buddhist scriptures, mainly from the long discourses, middle discourses, and the connected discourses. And I've tried to sort of pick up what's relevant and what's helpful and to try and share them with you. So there is this story about the Buddha's teachings about the body, and there was this Venerable Vijaya. So this is back in the Buddha's day, right? So is everyone familiar with Mara? Or am I saying something new? Mara? No? Anyone doesn't understand? Yeah, okay. So Mara, usually in the Buddhist context, is like kind of like obstruction, personified obstruction or inner challenges, but personified. So it's like a character, right? So there's this Venerable Vijaya who is quite enlightened, and during her meditation practice, this Mara tried to tempt Venerable Vijaya. But Venerable Vijaya, deep in concentration, actually answered the Mara and said that, I'm repelled and humiliated by this foul, putrid body, fragile and subject to breakdown. So this is not something new. So being quite an enlightened and observant person, they've quite rightly identified that this body is very much subjected to breakdown, right? And so as this body is subjected to breakdown, she wasn't tempted by whatever Mara was trying to say. You know, there's like nice smells, there's good taste, there's like handsome guys, whatever. And by the way, Venerable Vijaya is a female. and so that's part of it. And then the Buddha also said that the body does not belong to the self or does not belong to others. It is a result of old karma, to be seen and fashioned and generated by volition as something to be felt. Train yourself thus. Even though your body is afflicted, you should train such that your mind is unafflicted. Right? So, I think what the Buddha is essentially trying to say is that we all know the body is subjected to breakdown. Even though your body is subjected to breakdown, to disease, to pain, but train such that your mind is unaffected. So during the Buddha's time, there was this practice of the contemplation of the bodies. Right? So this essentially talks you through seeing the body as just the body. Seeing it as it is. Because when we see our bodies, we kind of think of, you know, this is a handsome body, this is a beautiful body, you know, this is a strong body, this is my body. We're not seeing it as it is. This combination of causes of conditions made up of different organs running by themselves beyond your control, beyond my control. We're not seeing it as it is. We're imagining it to be something that's not quite. You know, we're imagining it to be something, but the reality is not what we imagine. So he actually came up with this saying, all right, this is from the Buddhist scripture, I didn't make this up, okay. Look at the impurities of the body. Review this body from the soles to the tip of your hair. Enclosed in skin, full of many kinds of impurities. There's your hair, there's your body hair, there's a nail, there's your teeth, there's the skin, your flesh, your sinews, your bone marrow, kidneys, your heart, liver, pleura, spleen, lung, intestine, mesentery, contents of stomach, excretion, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, saliva, snot, fluid or joint, urine. Now, I didn't make this up, okay? This is what it was written in the scriptures. So, as you can see, the teachings of the Buddha, he actually went quite graphic. Well, not, I don't think intentional, but he's identifying it for what it is. I mean, have you seen movies and then the, you know, the couples kiss very passionately, tongues swashing around in each other's mouth, right? And then after that, it's like someone spits in their hands, the eee! But in actual fact, it's like, so that's acceptable and this is not. It's like, But if you see for it is, it's still saliva, you know? So we have a different perception of what these things are, suddenly it becomes acceptable. But when you spit it on the hand, it's like, eee. So there's a different perception of it. You know? Well, I apologize for this, but I often, because I see patients on the wards, and I just keep seeing them, and sometimes I start in the morning and I see them in the afternoon, right? It's afternoon by the time I get to them. And then they're having lunch, and I feel very awkward, but I kind of like, so, is your bowel motions normal? Yeah. What color is it? Is it brown or is it black? Are you having diarrhea? All this while they're like, yeah, it's normal. Yeah, it's normal. It's like, But it's like, wow, this guy is well practiced. It's like, see things as they are. You know, poo is poo, food is food. But in a 12 hours time, whatever he's putting in there is coming out just at the back passage. So, but when we see the body as it is, all the impurities, and we don't get attached so much to this beautiful body or this strong body or this handsome body, but just the body as the body, right? The bones are the bones, the sinews are the sinews, your saliva is the saliva, your poo is a poo, it's just poo. When you see it as that, then suddenly there's a sense of a bit of a detachment to it, you know? Like seeing a stranger on the road, do you feel very, I'm talking about a complete stranger, okay? Do you feel very passionate about this person that you just seen walking in front of you? You're not terribly passionate about this average Joe bloke walking across, right? Yet this is another body. This body is the same as, well, more or less, the same as your body, her body, his body. A body is a body. It's made of all these things, all these causes and conditions, all these cells, all these impurities as well. But our perception of our body is so much more precious than the body next to you, your friend. It's like, who cares if your friend has a scratch mark on his hand? Like, as long as it's not on my hand. Okay. So that's the body. That's what the Buddha has mentioned about the body. And there's these impurities of the body. So what did the Buddha say about death then? So he mentioned that, you know, there's the brokenness of teeth, grayness of hair, wrinkling of skin, decline of life, dullness of the faculties. Death is also, what is it? Oh, when someone asks, what is subject to death? Says, wife and husbands, men and women, slaves, goats, sheep, fowl, elephant, cattle, horses. Of course, back in the day, they used a lot of animals, so that's why they probably have so many animals in examples. Huh? So there was a conversation between one of the famous householders, Anatta Pintika. He's a very loyal, well-practiced lay person, disciple of the Buddha. And it was, Anatta Pintika is sick, maybe close to death's door, maybe. And he was having a conversation with Venerable Ananda. So paraphrasing, he says, Venerable Ananda, I'm very scared. I think I'm going to die. I'm very scared. So then, Venerable Ananda says, there is fear when there is distrust to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and also when there is immorality. So I guess, if you leave yourself, if you watch after your actions, your speech, and your thoughts well, and you have, you're pretty sure you haven't done anything wrong, then probably at death's door, there is no fear, because you haven't done anything wrong to anyone. And this next reading that I've had is also quite interesting. It's another conversation between a lay person, I think, by the name of Mahanama. So his question to the Buddha was, Buddha, what if my mindfulness of the triple gems is muddled at the time of death? What will happen? What will be my next destination? So as most of you know, in the traditional Indian religions, most of them believe in life after death. And in Buddhism, there is also mention of rebirth. But not dwelling into the specifics, there is this general thing of, oh, where am I going next after death, right? So this is what this question he put to the Buddha about. Then the Buddha said, don't be afraid. Your demise will not be a bad one. Okay, when a person's mind has been fortified over a long time by faith, virtue, learning, generosity, and wisdom, right here, even at death, and he quoted various creatures including hawks, vultures, crows, jackals, eating his body, which essentially means the body's breaking down, right? Consisting of form, composed of four great elements, originating from father and mother, built up out of rice and gruel, subject to impermanence, to be breaking apart and dispersal. But the mind, if cultivated, goes upwards, goes to distinction. Yeah? So he uses an analogy. He says, suppose, Mahanama, a man submerges a pot full of ghee or pot of oil in a deep pool of water. Okay? And he breaks the pot. All of its shards and fragments will sink downwards. Okay? But the ghee or oil will rise upwards. So too, Mahanama, when a person's mind has been fortified over a long time by faith, virtue, learning, generosity, and wisdom, even though his body breaks up, his mind goes upwards. So this is a very good saying or teaching from the Buddha, saying that, you know, yes, we all know that the body is subjected to breakup, death and decay, but the mind is a different story. Now, I'm not enlightened and I haven't been very well trained in my mind, but this saying does mention quite significantly that there is a way to train your mind such that even when your body breaks up at death or sickness or whatever, your mind is still free. Your mind can still be free. It can still go upwards. Or by going upwards, I suppose, a better place, a happy state, I suppose, if you will. Yeah? So then, how do we actually go about seeking this development of the mind, you know, training the mind to happiness, I suppose? And so, further readings from it is talking about seeking deathlessness. I wouldn't say it's a literal deathlessness from the body, because the Buddha also quite frankly put it that, you know, your body is subject to breakdown. So the deathlessness is more about your mind, I suppose. And so the teachings he's made about seeking deathlessness is from, he mentioned about the noble search leading to Nibbana, seeking supreme liberty from bondage, which, if we take a step back and look at it, is essentially attachment, isn't it? Yeah? I mean, we all get a bit upset when certain things we hold dear break down, such as your mobile phone, maybe. I don't know, your favorite pot, you know. For those of you who like cooking, you know, probably your oven, if it spoils, it's a nightmare. I don't know, something that you hold dear. If it spoils, you're upset. But why are we upset? I mean, who cares? The next iPhone's out. If your phone spoils, you can just get the new one. But if it's something you hold dear, something that you cling on to strongly, then there is a sense of, I don't want it to break down, I don't want it to be spoiled. But yet it is. That's when we get upset. Because who cares if your friend's phone spoils? Like, it's his phone, man, I don't care. I hope he breaks up his data, but I don't care if it breaks. You're not upset over it. He is, you're not. Because it's not yours. You're not attached to it. So the same thing goes deeply with the body. Any questions so far? Are we still awake? No, it's Friday night. Have you guys had dinner? Okay. Which kind of leads me to my next point. So I had a few objectives trying to cover tonight's talk, and I think we're doing pretty well with time. In fact, we might end quite early. I think the next thing that I wanted to bring up was, it's important to know where we are in our own spiritual practice, you know? Like, so far tonight, I've talked about, you know, the body is subjected to breakdown, you can't control your body. I don't know how much of that went to your head. Maybe it just went, it's like, can't remember what that guy yesterday at EDT said, but he said something about dying. And that we can be happy even though we are dying. Something like that. So I hope that's not the case, but, you know, it's been a tiring day. So, what I've tried to cover earlier on is to give a sense that we have this illusion of control of our body, right? But it's also very important for us to realize where we are in our spiritual path. Because sure, it's easy to say all these things. It's easy to give you examples and, you know, draw diagrams and say, this is your heart, that's your lung, you know, this connects to this, but, you know, this is your body and it's, you can't control it. It's easy to say, but it's quite difficult for us to put in practice. And by that I mean, if I say that, oh, you're gonna die tomorrow, I'm pretty sure you'll break down in tears, man. I will. So even though I have given you all these examples and said all these things, it's still up there in the air. It's still a concept. It's still, you know, something that Ming just said. It's not, we're not able to just, unless you're really, really well trained at the moment and say this, whoa, let go of body, I'm enlightened, man. All good, no worries. I'll see you. It doesn't matter if my body breaks down. I'm all good, man. I'm all set. So if you are, well, great. Teach me how to do it. Because now we've understood a little bit more about the body. But deep down inside us, in our hearts and our minds, we're not quite ready to let go yet. Agree? Don't know? Shocked? Speechless. Okay. So it's quite important to realize which part of the spiritual path we're at. You know, we're just beginning to learn a little bit about letting go, learning a bit about the impermanence of the body. Or are we quite well trained and say that, okay, I really am ready to let go of the body? Because looking at ourselves and looking at some of the very senior monks and the nuns, clearly there is a distinction. The senior monks and nuns have spent most of their lives practicing, meditating, learning about the teachings of the Buddha, and really taking on board those teachings and learning to let go. Whereas for us, maybe for some of you it's the first time hearing a talk like this, and for the last, maybe hearing something for the last half an hour, we don't expect us to just suddenly gain enlightenment and just snap our fingers and go, yes, no problems, man, I'm good. So, talking about all these things about the body, I was also hoping that we don't go the other way around and say, I hate this body. This body is ugly, it's filthy, it's filled with pee and poo. Well, actually, we are kind of carrying our pee and poo around until we go to the toilet, and then we make more of it. But still, let's not suddenly jump onto the wagon and the non-self wagon and say, this is not my body, right? I've let go of this body. Push this body aside. Then this becomes a sense of aversion. Correct? You're actively trying to push something away. We're not accepting of it. We're trying to push it away. Right? So, at our level of understanding, and especially as lay people, we need to work, you know, we get sick. This is day in, day out, daily life. We need to understand that at our level, our minds are not that well trained. Alright? Our body and our mind are very much interconnected. I'm pretty sure you're not aware of what you're doing when you're asleep. Correct? Yeah. And last time you were sick, try and recall that period of time. Were you able to do a complicated math question? Or do your physics question, talking about quantum mechanics, all the formulas? Are you able to do that? Well, you can't, right? Because when you're sick, you feel lousy, correct? You feel like crap. You're not even able to concentrate. But why is this happening? Why is your state of mind so different from 2-3 weeks ago when you were eating well, drinking well, happy? That's because our body and mind still influence each other. Okay? I'm not talking about, you know, we have absolute mind control over our body. There are some very well practitioners who, there are more and more scientific studies starting to show that there is a sense that they can do certain kind of controls. I think they've done experiments where, like in Tibet, like high up in the mountains, it's cold, and all they're wearing is like a simple robe. I mean, if you and I went there, I'd probably be 4 or 5 layers at least, maybe. But there they are wearing a simple robe, and they go into this cave. It's not like a fancy cave, okay? It's just a simple stone cave. It's cold, it's freezing for you and I, but they're able to sit there in meditation, and then they go into a deep sense of meditation. And I think some of the studies they've done is that they've put on wet towels on their bodies, and then they observe that they dry up quite quickly, as opposed to a control where maybe they just put wet towels, I don't know, on a rock or something. So, but and they don't go through just one wet towel. They go through like 3 wet towels just to be sure. You know, it's not like a random freak of nature, but it's a properly done study. And it's not, I think it's not just one specific practitioner, it's a few. And I think they also use all sorts of fancy equipment, you know, maybe apart from thermometers, I think they maybe use some, okay, I know it's not, the thermometer is not fancy, okay. But either way, they're able to observe their core body temperature, and it has remained quite constant in their meditative state. So yes, these are very well-trained practitioners. There probably is a certain degree where the mind is able to regulate the rest of the body. But for regular Joe Bloke like you and I, let's try and understand that we're not at that level. Okay? And recognizing that is very helpful, because then you don't go doing stupid things. Like going into a cave, in a cold cave, trying to meditate and try to achieve that same effect, because we're just not that well trained yet. Right? So what I'm trying to get at is, at our level, our mind and our body is very much interconnected. If you're healthy, you usually, if you sleep well, if you eat well, your mind is quite clear, you can focus, you can do your complicated math question or quantum mechanics or solve some difficult equation that I've got no idea what is written there. Conversely, if you're sick, then your state of mind is affected. You can't concentrate. Or even day to day, if you have a very heavy lunch, just trying to stay awake after lunch is a nightmare. At the same time, our minds, if you're very stressed, even though you're relatively healthy physically, you still get tired all the time, right? Close to exam time, who's not stressed? If you're not stressed, great! But if you're stressed, I can bet you that every day you just want to sleep. You just want to eat. You just want to do anything but study. Am I right? I know, because I'm also doing the same thing. And in a way, it's evolutionary, okay? Because back when we were cavemen, our stresses are not so much related to exams or paying bills. Our stress is related to not finding food, starving, or getting chased by saber-toothed tigers. Correct? So our response then is to run or to find food. And it's true, because in those situations, from an evolution perspective, when we eat food, we get a sense of happiness. Which is why, you know, chocolates, potato chips, fries, everything that's oily and guilty is the best tasting when you're stressed. It's not all your fault. Partly it's evolution. But the problem is, our stress is no longer running from saber-toothed tigers, it's from exams. So instead of running off all that fat, we're sitting there accumulating all the fat. Okay? And I've lost my train of thought. So yes, mental stress as it is, right? So, I don't know if you've ever experienced this or if some of you do your own meditation practice, but if you're very stressed, right, before you go to bed, if you just try and do a bit of meditation, no need to force yourself to sit for half an hour or, you know, forcing yourself really to focus on your breath. Just letting your body and mind just relax. Just letting it settle. Just dropping it. You may find to your surprise that, number one, you don't need to sleep as much. And when you wake up in the morning, you're actually more refreshed than, say, sleeping for 9 hours and just waking up feeling like crap. You know? Because the mind is still has an interplay with the body. That's what I'm trying to get. So before we all go saying, alright, this body is not mine, I'm not gonna pay any attention to it. Hang on, at our level, we're still pretty much attached to our body, we're still pretty much attached to our mind. So we need to do a good job looking after it. What did the Buddha say before he gained enlightenment? There was one critical realization. When he almost starved to death from ascetic practices, there was one thing that he heard from a passerby, or different versions of the story, but sort of like a passerby saying something. And that sort of made him realize that he was doing things the wrong, not exactly the wisest way. Was that if the string of the instrument is too tight, if you play it, it breaks. If it's too lax, then the sound's not nice. So the string has to be just nice, right? So in a similar way, with our body and our minds, you have to balance these two things out, and to achieve an optimal efficiency, you know, you can't starve your body too much, or eat too much. And at the same time, which we often neglect is our mind, you know. The body is quite easy to say, oh, if you're hungry, go and eat. You know, if you're too fat, go exercise, something like that. But what about our minds? Nobody ever tells you to say, if your mind is too scattered, sit down and let it concentrate. If your mind is too dull, do something to try and energize it or refresh it. You know? So these two things have to come together at the right balance. And there's quite a lot of Buddhist teachings on this, including the five strengths and the five hindrances that we should be aware of. But that's another topic for another day. Maybe that's an idea sometime for your other Dhamma talk. So we need to develop our health and also our mental health while we're at this stage. You know, and the general things are, if you're sick, rest. If you feel you're unfit, go for a jog. Do something. Because it does affect your mind as well. And at the same time, if your mind is very difficult or unsettled, spend some time nurturing that as well, because it does influence your body. And I'll give you some examples. Some of the causes of gastric ulcers, which are ulcers inside your stomach. You know, your stomach is a very acidic place. It produces a lot of acid. But day in, day out, you and I, we don't get ulcers in the stomach. Not easily. And I suspect that well-trained Buddhists probably don't. Because, believe it or not, when you're stressed, there's a greater incidence of stomach ulcers when you're stressed. Because what happens is, when you're stressed, your blood vessels in your so-called not as essential organs, again, this goes back to evolution. When you're being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, don't bother about digesting your food, right? Run for your life. So your body redistributes the blood by constricting the vessels in the organs that are not important at the time of life or death. So it pushes the blood outside of your stomach, you know, your intestines, and it goes to your muscles. That's where you need the most. You need to run, right? So fast forward a couple of 100,000 years today, you and I being stressed, sitting in a chair about our next assignment, next due date, the body responds the same. It still constricts the blood vessels in the stomach, intestine, it still pushes your blood to your muscles and things. Except that we're not running. Right? And also, apart from being in the past caveman days, you run away from a tiger and two things happen. Either you survive or you get eaten. So the episode is short, correct? Either you get eaten or, you know, you run away and you survive. But here we are sitting at our desk, stressing over our exams, 24 hours a day for about 3 weeks before the exam comes. So the stress response is there for much longer. So sure, you know, if it's a short time, your body recovers after that. But if you're stressed for that period of time, yes, your body will start running into problems. You get stomach ulcers, I don't know, you get all sorts of weird aches or pains. And some of it is related to the stress response. So looking after your mental health, relieving that stress, actually is quite beneficial to your body as well. Is that something that you've never realized or not quite emphasized? I think in the modern society, we sort of place a lot of emphasis on our physical body, but we haven't been emphasizing very much on our mind, our mental states. And a lot of diseases, especially diseases of the affluent world, you know, Western, so-called Western worlds or rich worlds, they're more of these sort of problems. So yes, don't neglect your physical health, but neither don't neglect your mental health as well. So, being in a uni, this talk is, you know, we expect most of the audience to be students, or at least some of them. You know, exercise. I know you're too busy. It's okay. Go for a bit of a walk. Attend the Sunday exercise sessions. It's helpful. And sleep. Yes, students, you do need to sleep. Believe it or not, gaming until 3 in the morning and then sleeping at about 9 o'clock is not helpful. And, oh, did I say something? Or are some of you doing that? Sorry, what was that? Okay, something happening there, it's okay. But you need to know your own limits, and you need to understand your body and mind. Because your body and mind and my body and mind is very different. Males are different than females from a, you know, it's just the way it is. Some of us are born a bit more muscular, some of us have been born a bit more flabby. There's differences. There's differences. But you got to know your own limits. You have to know where you are, and that's helpful. Okay. You know, if you're trying to keep fit, don't go for a 10K run just out of the blue. It's not going to happen. Right? You'll probably collapse. This is pulling the string too tight. It will snap. You got to take it up. The same thing goes with your meditation practice or your mental practice. Don't force yourself to just do, it's like, you know, today after the talk, it's like, yes, I will develop my mind. I will go for a 10-hour meditation non-stop. I will build up my mind. It's like, it's okay, just chill, okay? You will probably fall asleep, or you'll probably go crazy before you achieve anything. It's a gradual process, okay? Just like the body, our mind takes time to get used to certain things. Like you go to the gym, the first few days you're bound to get muscle aches because you're not used to flexing that set of muscles. But as you work out more, it starts to build up a bit more strength there, that muscle group gets developed better. It's the same thing with your mind. You keep on doing your meditation practice, whatever practice it is, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you keep on doing it. Eventually, there comes a point when your mind's like, okay, it's time for meditation now. It's like, okay, I'll be happy, I'll just sit quietly, kind of thing. And then build on that. Okay. So know your own limits and know that there is this interplay between your body and mind. Very good. Any questions so far? Have I lost anyone? Has everyone gone to sleep? Okay. So, which leads me to the last part of the talk, which is, sure, we've explored how the body is impermanent, is subjected to change, is subjected to death and decay. We've come to realize that there is a way out of it, kind of. Developing your mind, being unattached, and also exploring that our body and mind at this stage is still, we're still very much attached to it, we need to look after both sides to keep it going, to be able to progress. Yeah? So the last part is about showing gratitude. So why am I saying this? Because if you think about it, many things can go wrong along the way of our lives, correct? Most of us are, I don't know, 20, 30 something. So there's that 20, 30 years of your life that has the potential to go wrong. And like I've mentioned, there's so many organs in our bodies, and all of them, believe it or not, if you look up Google, say liver problems or brain problems or something, you can find a list of problems that can go wrong. Diseases, accidents, things like that that can go wrong. But yet, here we are, quite intact and healthy, and with our senses intact and our mind intact. We haven't gone insane yet, so that's a good thing. There's so many different causes and conditions at play, with so many potentials that can go wrong, and yet it hasn't. And while we like to think that it's all us and our efforts that have brought us here, it's actually quite a lot of factors that eventually brought us here. But first of all, our parents gave birth to us. Yeah? The first few moments of our lives, we're very vulnerable. We're vulnerable to infections, diseases, heat, cold. Believe it or not, when you're first born, it's quite difficult to regulate your own body temperature. You and I, if we're cold, our developed brain says grab a blanket. Or take off the extra blanket. But an undeveloped brain of a baby just doesn't quite have that capacity to do it. And so we need to develop on our mother's protection, our parents' protection. Yeah? And, you know, sickness is unavoidable, infections are unavoidable, but we get the right medicines. And who brings us to see the doctors when we're sick? You know, parents. And I'm not forgetting the doctors. Thank you. Who prescribe the right medications. And just going back to our parents, you know, it's not just the physical protection or bringing us to see the doctors. It's also the amount of time they've spent with us, you know, educating us, teaching us what's right, what's wrong. You know, we haven't gone robbing banks or killing people. These things are very moral things. We didn't know them from day one. Certainly there's a lot of influence from other people, but some of our earliest teachers, in the language we speak, who taught you your first ba-ba, bo-bo, ga-ga? Our parents. And then they feed us. Maybe ask your parents, you know, did you sit there and let them feed you, or were you the kind that went running around and said, hey, come back, ah. But they've spent that effort to nurture us. So, yes, this body and mind has a lot of causes and conditions that come into play before we are what we are. So being able to be here, it's, I think we have to acknowledge all that time, energy, food, protection, education. And even in times of difficulties when we feel it's quite painful, why are you scolding me and things like that, but it's probably for a good reason, teaching us what's right from what's wrong. It's not just our parents, it's our siblings as well, our other family members, our friends, taught us to have fun, to, and also especially here, to with our spiritual friends as well, encouraging each other, sort of making sure we're not falling down in times of stress, and not forgetting our teachers, especially quite a lot of our spiritual teachers as well, giving us talks, teaching us on how to be kind, compassionate, especially in the case of the Buddha, teaching us a way of coming out of suffering. And also approaching this rather difficult topic of death and dying. So, yeah. So just thinking about it, with all the things that can potentially go wrong, still being intact and healthy, being here, I think it's definitely a collective effort from many people as well. So let's not forget that. And so with that, I think I'll come to the end of my talk. Just quickly recapping once again that, you know, sometimes we have this illusion that we can control our body, but in actual fact, we can't. And that the main source of our suffering, with this inevitable destruction or breaking down of the body, is our attachment. And to be able to let go of that attachment is, or accepting of it, is a, you know, it's a, there'll be less suffering involved. But to also realize that, let's not go flip the other way and say, okay, this body is not mine, let's just do whatever we want, or don't do anything at all. But to realize that our body and mind are still very much interconnected, especially when we're at this stage where we're not well trained or enlightened. But let's keep working towards it so that we can be happy. And that with all these causes and conditions that make up all these things, that there are many other people and beings involved who have helped nurture us and this body and mind. So with that, I end and open up for questions, comments, anything at all. Yes?
I just want to ask a question, like, you say in the talk, like, we come to this talk because of the kind of like our past karma. So I just want to know, like, if let's say, like, for instance, like, let's say, like, sorry to say this, let's say like, I slap you, and then, like, sorry, it doesn't mean like, is it like because of your past karma in which like, you get a slap of me, or I creating a new karma? In which, like, because I slap you, like, I'm creating a new karma, or you just like your old karma just kind of like.
Okay.
Well, I know, like, karma is a bit hard to explain, and it's like one of the, I think, three things that even Buddha tried to say, like, please don't think too much, it will make you crazy.
Yes, yes.
But I just want to know what's your opinion about it.
Sure. So look, you're right. The Buddha did mention that one of the things that if you go into too much detail of, will drive you crazy. And this is well written in the suttas, in the scriptures. But on the same note, karma is, this is based on what I've read and my understanding of it. So, a lot of karma is from volition, from intention. I'll give an example, and this is from scriptures as well, that during the Buddha's time, there was this monk who was enlightened already, but he was blind. So during his walking meditation practice, he couldn't see the ants on the ground. So he actually stepped on some of them. But it wasn't intentional. He's blind, and he's just doing his meditation practice. So then someone actually asked this question to the Buddha and said, you know, is this enlightened monk committing any ill karma? And his answer was no, because there was no intention involved in killing and in stepping on the ant. So I guess if I infer from that reading, then if you have an intention to slap me, and if you harbor an ill intention, then yes, you are creating some ill karma. And in some way or another, then this will probably have some negative effects on you. For me, I'm the one who received the slap. I don't know if it's my past bad karma that I received this, but certainly if I accept it and I don't harbor ill intentions towards you, then whatever bad karma, if this is what bad karma is resolved there. However, you having that intention to harm another person, then that is ill karma being created. Does that sort of answer your question? It's a lot to do with your intention. Yeah. So, say, let's take another, just slightly different angle to this, is one of the basic five precepts is not to kill, correct? So in the strictest sense, it's not to kill another human, okay? Because if you think back 2,500 years ago, there are still many people who do kill animals for food, right? So when the Buddha mentioned the five precepts, it's more geared towards lay people and not harming another person. So if you step on an ant, right? And I'm not saying you. Let's just take, for example, someone steps on an ant with an intention, right? The ant itself is a small creature. So, while not ideal, the amount of hatred or cruelty that you can amass to step on this tiny creature compared to you harboring enough ill intention to pick up a knife and stab someone, for example, can you see that the scale is very different? Yeah? Am I making sense? Like, the amount of energy, the intent. Like, it's for you and I, who are otherwise normal, not psychopaths, to pick up a knife or weapon and to intentionally harm another one to the point of death, it takes a lot of cruel intention to do that. Agree? Yeah? I'm not talking about, you know, mentally ill people, but just normal people. So can you see the scale of stepping on an ant and the scale of intentionally harming another person? It's very, very different. Yeah? So trying to understand that, you know, your intention has a lot of influence on your karma. Okay? So that's what I'm trying to say is, you know, in the end, it comes back to your mind. If you have that amount of cruelty in your mind to harm another person, it's very, very, very different to you trying to harm a small ant. So that is the so-called the heaviness, the weight of the karma. Probably comes back to your intention, your mind. Make sense?
More or less. It's the same, like, for mind and thought.
It's a bit difficult for me to answer that question. I think a thought is probably a mental process. You know, loosely translated, the word thought can be many things. It could be, you know, are you thinking of a picture, or are you thinking of something? It could be a visualization, it could be a word, it could be something. But so it's manifested as a process, a mental formation. So yes, in the scriptures it does say that the mind is the forerunner of things. So it may come with the intent to think of something, or it just pops up like that. But I think there, in the strictest sense, there is a bit of a difference between a mind and a thought. Yes.
In your example of the patient not wanting to die,
mm-hmm.
are they too far? Like, do they have to? Is there some way to make them
not die?
Karma, a bit more karma, or like, do they really have to practice it?
Look, I think from a medical perspective, or from a human perspective, really, our aim is to try and reduce suffering. Yeah. So, if someone's mind is ready for it, then if your body suffers, but the mind is ready, then there's not very much that you need to do, because at the time of the body breaking down, the mind is ready. There's no hatred, there's no ill will, there's no suffering in the mind. But short of that, and we don't, you know, you can't just train the mind in the last 5 seconds of death and say, be calm, be calm. It's not going to happen. So the next best thing we can do is to try and reduce bodily suffering. Because, you know, if you, say for example, when you take a shower after a day's work, you feel calm, right? You feel relaxed. So the body, like I said, the body exerts some effect on the mind as well when we're very untrained in that sense. So we can try and reduce bodily suffering. And so, yes, in the hospitals, what we do is, if we see they're very agitated, yes, we do give some medication to try and reduce that. And as the body calms down a bit, you can see that there's less resistance, and they're generally more a bit calmer as well. Yeah.
And like, what about another question? What about in cases where some people, like, when they see things or situations, they really want to, like, die. But then when they're actually faced with death,
mm-hmm.
they're really, really scared.
Mm-hmm.
What would be a good teaching for those people? Oh, is it too generic?
No, sorry. I'm just trying to understand the question. So, some people who want to die, but when they're faced with it, but they're not ready. Is that right?
Yeah.
Uh huh. What kind of teachings are available? Is it?
Yeah. Sometimes, like, we see on the news, people commit suicide or something like that,
mm-hmm.
and like, is there a good way to make them realize the value of life?
Yeah, it's a bit hard, because I suppose if they truly hold that, then they wouldn't have harmed themselves in the first place. But often you find that in these people who are driven to suicide, there's usually a lot of suffering that they bear. And sometimes it's situational, but more often than not, it's a lot of mental stress, feeling helpless, just like what they say, not seeing a way out. So, you know, kind of like death seems like a good option. But in actual fact, and at least from a Buddhist perspective, you know, death doesn't actually resolve all the problems. In most teachings, there is a teaching of rebirth. So, you know, we keep coming back until hopefully we get enlightenment. So if you think about it, you don't solve the problems, you die. Then there's more problems that keep rolling down. It just doesn't resolve. And also from another perspective, from another Buddhist perspective, is that there's no harming, right? There's no harming of another sentient being. But by intentionally killing yourself, you're also harming a being, which is this being, yourself, another being. So that's, yeah. So that'll be the general Buddhist perspective on it. And look, can you persuade someone from not killing themselves? Well, we try to. That's when a lot of the compassion comes out. But it also comes from a deep understanding of where their pain and suffering is coming from. And it's not easy. If it was, then I think suicide rates would probably drop to zero. Teachings-wise, value of life, look, I think it's very individual, and it's what that person believes in. If that person holds dearly that life is valuable, then they probably wouldn't be doing that in the first place anyways. So yeah, that's why it's important to cultivate our minds all this time, because in the last 5 seconds of death or last couple of minutes, it's not going to make, you're not going to be able to just switch like that. Which is what the example of the Buddha is, you know, like the pot and the oil. So if you're well trained, or rather if you make an effort to develop that, no matter what happens, the general trend of your mind is towards goodness, then that's it. You will always hit that. You can't go too far away. Yeah. Sorry, I don't have a specific teaching or sutta that can answer that question, but I think this will be the general perspectives on suicide and things. Yeah. Good. Any questions?
There's no more questions. Then we can finish up. Thank you.